verses 12:27-06 and 13:20-04, Goldman versus Gagnard. And it is Mr. Epstein. Hi, Mr. Epstein.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honor. David Epstein on behalf of the appellants in the two appeals. This is a case that arises in now the fifth forum in which this case has been heard.
Fifth forum. A house.
Because this case arises because of the division, which is either bifurcation or arguably trifurcation, of the underlying litigation, where no one trial court, no one forum initially had jurisdiction over all of the issues or all of the parties to make an allocation, make a set-off to determine which of the culpable parties should pay which portion of the damages to the house. So here we are, years later, in the fifth forum, still asking for an allocation of the $1.9 million settlement that Mrs. Goldman got for the house damages.
I guess it seems to me that you could have done that in the Santa Clara Superior Court when the case was pending there.
We tried.
Well, and failing, that you would have appealed that to get that corrected if that ruling was erroneous.
No, actually, the ruling was not erroneous, but the ruling did not address this issue.
Everybody was there, though.
No, everybody was not there.
You had the one, the plaintiff had the $1.9 million settlement, right, as of that point?
The plaintiff had the settlement. The settling parties, the nine subcontractors, were not in the Campy case. The general contractor was in the Campy case.
But you told the district judge in California to, you wanted to stay that enforcement of the arbitration pending the Santa Clara case so that that issue could be resolved there.
Well, so that a couple of issues could be resolved. But
the set-off being one of them.
Well, the set-off for the Campy case, if there was a recovery. The Campy case was a case where the Gagnards sued the realtor who had not been, and the general contractor who had dropped out of the first case, and the realtor. Realtor hadn't been part of anything. This was a new case where we sought liability. Now, in our case, here comes Mrs. Goldman seeking yet more money. She'd already recovered from the subs $1.9 million. She had got an arbitration award against us for $1.1, including $400,000 of attorney's fees. And now she's coming in against, in our case, against the realtor, seeking more money from the realtor. So we then tried a cross-claim, but the cross-claim was styled as a claim against the award, not an offset against the judgment, which, frankly, it should have been, but it wasn't. So the court ruled that the claim, the Gagnard claim against the award, was precluded. The court couldn't consider that, and the court was right. You couldn't consider an appeal from the award. That's right. But he wouldn't let them amend to bring a later case. So the question becomes, in answer to Your Honor, did we have to bring it there? Nobody is arguing in this case, Mrs. Goldman is not arguing, that this was a mandatory claim then, a cross-claim between those two plaintiffs in the Campy case. Nobody's arguing that. And moreover, I would point out a thought which occurred to our side. Had we brought our claim for set-off, remember, our claim for set-off is a claim for partial satisfaction of the judgment, not full satisfaction, partial satisfaction due to payment of the same damages by other parties. So there's a very strong argument that our set-off claim isn't ripe until there's enforcement against us. That's the point at which you will reach or may reach the point where our payment is in excess of what we should pay. So had we again tried to bring this claim, the set-off claim, which requires the allocation, which is where we got in trouble. That's the reason that nobody would do it, because Mrs. Goldman and the subs hadn't done the allocation, which was required under California law, according to the arbitrator, Judge Lynch. So they didn't do that, so we couldn't get a set-off because we couldn't get the allocation. That's the problem. There's two issues there.
Well, you're claiming that they never received a ruling on the merits.
They didn't.
And
not on this issue.
If we assume for the sake of argument that the arbitrator didn't actually rule on the merits, but that, you know, the subsequent courts mistakenly assumed that the arbitrator had ruled on the merits, why didn't they appeal those decisions? In other words, as soon as the courts misapprehended the arbitrator's ruling, why didn't they appeal then?
Well, the only court that misapprehended was the Campy Court. And the Campy Court, well, that was, as I tried to explain to Judge Tinder, that was a slightly different issue. That was an issue of an attack on the award, not on an offset against the judgment. But if you were to consider that a ruling on the merits, which I think is wrong, mm-hmm. I think it's a question, because when the judge said, well, it was decided by the arbitrator, what he is inherently then saying is it's an arbitration issue, it's not a justiciable issue. And that's a jurisdictional ruling, and it's not res judicata. But even if you considered it to be res judicata at that point, the case was settled, so you never had a final judgment, never had an appeal that could be taken. So you have a settlement of all the claims in that case, and money was exchanged. No release has been tendered here or presented here. So the issue simply died. So it seems to me, and I respectfully submit, that the offset issue is properly presentable and probably not before the first enforcement action, or an enforcement action which could give rise to a payment. But now we're past that. We paid the judgment. And the question is, can we seek unjust enrichment for improper amounts, both the prejudgment interest, which the court awarded, we say, without jurisdiction, because it was an arbitration issue, and for the set-off, to acquire multiple recovery. Now, the basis upon which the district court dismissed the counterclaim said, well, there's no claim, so you can't file a counterclaim. But, of course, there was a claim. The claim by Mrs. Goldman was to enforce the judgment and obtain property. That's a request for a judicial remedy based on an assertion of entitlement. That's a claim. Now, it seems to me that we're entitled one time, somewhere, in some court, to litigate these issues. There has never been a ruling on the merits. Nobody has ever said, you're not entitled to an offset. She's not recovering multiple times. I think it's very clear she is.
But it's very difficult to imagine that a citation proceeding is the right place to raise the offset claim or the set-off claim.
It's exactly the right place. First of all, Illinois law clearly allows it. Second of all, the citation claim, when you say we're enforcing a judgment. Now, if you have a set-off against that judgment, for example, another judgment in another case, or as this case, a payment by somebody else, that's precisely the point at which you say, how much can you really collect? That's what the court is supposed to determine. I mean, the requirement of a citation is to say, which is why we moved to dismiss it originally, this is entirely unsatisfied. That's wrong. It was partially satisfied. That judgment for water damages was partially, at least, satisfied elsewhere. And we have been running around hither and yon from court, from arbitrator to court, trying to get somebody to say, okay, how much of that $1.9 million was for the water damages, and if she's already gotten that, why should we pay it a second time? It's simple. On the prejudgment interest issue, that's a question of the who gets to decide the prejudgment interest. We say that is part of the relief to be awarded in the case. That is exclusively for the arbitrator. Every case in this court, in the U.S. Supreme Court, where there's been a judicial versus arbitrator decision, the courts have been consistent in saying the arbitrator gets to award everything up to the point of judgment. That's which is the confirmation procedure. We've cited the cases. I don't think I need to belabor it. Those are the two issues. Do we ever get to litigate them anywhere? Mrs. Goldman's position is, well, I didn't do an allocation, and there's a procedural reason here and a procedural reason there and a jurisdictional reason here. You never get to litigate it. I'm happy to answer. My time's up. I'm happy to answer any questions.
I'm going to let Mr. Banach answer all those questions.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hi, Mr. Banach.
Good morning, Judge Rovner.
Are you a double dipper?
Yes.
Is Mrs. Goldman just getting unjustly enriched?
Well, we would obviously respectfully say the answer to that is no.
I think the lawyers are getting rich.
This case does have a certain jaundice versus jaundice element to it. I will agree with that. It did not go on quite as long as the famous case that counted by Charles Dickens, but...
You're young. You're both very young.
Who knows? We may be here in another 20 years. I should have said good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Terry Banach, and along with my partner, Bob Fishman, we represent Susan Goldman. Now, although resolved on procedural grounds below, this case is really about principles of finality. The fact that Mr. Epstein has conceded, as he must, that the Gagnards have litigated and lost what we refer to in our brief as the set-off issue and the prejudgment interest issue multiple times and in multiple different fora. And as Your Honors aptly noted during Mr. Epstein's time, the Gagnards made the strategic decision, for whatever reason, not to appeal the adverse rulings that were in favor of Mrs. Goldman. And I think that as a result, you have to take into account the argument that's being made here that, well, the Gagnards have never had a chance to litigate this issue. Well, in our view, principles of finality come into play here multiple times. Frankly, the Gagnards and Goldman have been litigating in one form or each other or another since April of 2008. And the heart of the matter is they declined to avail themselves of the applicable procedures under California law to file an action in the Superior Court of California to seek to vacate or modify the arbitration award to the extent that they thought the arbitrator got it wrong. Now, on the point that the appellants make that no one has heard them or the prior fora have refused to entertain that issue, it's belied by the record in spades. And the arbitration is really where it all began. The Gagnards filed no less than four briefs on the allocation or set-off issue before the arbitrator.
But where exactly did the Gagnards get a ruling on the merits on the offset claim? The arbitrator seemed to say could not decide the issue, but then he said it was denied, and subsequent courts took that as a ruling on the merits. But where is the ruling on the merits?
Now, to answer your question, Judge Rovner, it's on the merits as between Goldman and the Gagnards. The arbitrator decided the set-off issue. It was denied. Now, it's clear that the contractors and other parties weren't before the arbitrator. So to the extent that Gagnards were complaining to the arbitrator, look, we need to an allocation between us and the contractors, which clearly smacks of indemnity, that the Gagnards' rights against the absent contractors were for another day. That's what the arbitrator was saying. But as between the parties before the arbitrator finally decided the issue of whether or not the Gagnards were entitled to a set-off from Susan Goldman. In fact, the Campy case, which the Gagnards filed during the pendency of the arbitration, the whole purpose of it was to start to obtain some relief for the Gagnards as against some of the contractors and even the real estate broker.
So that was the proper form for the Gagnards to make their set-off claim?
Apparently the Gagnards thought so because that's the lawsuit that they instituted. Now,
that's the one they didn't appeal from.
That's one of the ones they didn't appeal from.
The arbitrator said, the ball's not in my court, so where should it have been brought?
Well, I think the Gagnards did what was reasonable and logical under the, at the time, they filed a lawsuit against everybody who wasn't part of the arbitration. However, there's sort of a myth that sort of developed through the course of this litigation, is that at no one time were all the players before one judge or arbitrator to decide all the contested issues. The suggestion being that Susan Goldman and the Gagnards were together as parties in the arbitration, but none of the contractors were. And then in the Campy litigation, which followed, it was the Gagnards versus the contractors, but Susan Goldman wasn't involved. Now, if the Gagnards really thought that Susan Goldman was a necessary party to the litigation, where they were seeking indemnity, breach of contract damages from the contractors, why didn't they name Susan Goldman as a defendant in Campy? The only reason Goldman became a party to Campy at all is because she intervened as a plaintiff to try to recover some additional money. At that point, she had not yet been made whole.
But how could she be a defendant?
If you go back to the arbitration, the Gagnards were making the claim that Goldman owed them money, that the amount of damages that she was being awarded should be set off. They were seeking relief against her. They were trying to persuade the arbitrator to award her less money.
So the contractors should have made her a defendant.
Well, they didn't.
I mean,
regardless of what should have happened in the prior
litigation.
But she did
come into that case.
She intervened as a plaintiff.
And the Gagnards counterclaim against her.
Against her, yes. And they raised the set-off issue again. And this time it was in before a judge as opposed to the arbitrator. All the contractors were present. And at that point, however, the amount of time that the Gagnards had to challenge the arbitration award under applicable California law had passed. So the arbitration award, whatever it purported to decide in Goldman's favor or against the Gagnards, the time to challenge that judicially had passed. So Goldman, in response to the Gagnards' claim against her that they were entitled to a set-off from her, she defended, moved to dismiss, and said, look, the arbitration award has res judicata effect. And the Superior Court judge in California said, that's right. Under California law, principles of res judicata, collateral estoppel, apply with full effect to an arbitration proceeding as they do to any other judicial proceeding. And so, as a result, that claim was dismissed with prejudice.
And then the balance of the case settled.
That's correct.
And no appeal was taken from the dismissal of the counterclaim.
That's correct. So there's an argument in the Gagnards' reply brief that an order, in using California parlance, an order sustaining a demurrer without leave to amend, which translating that to federal parlance is an order dismissing a claim with prejudice, is the Gagnards suggest that was merely an interlocutory order from which no appeal could have been taken. That's false. The Gagnards do not respond or acknowledge the cases we cite from California and the Ninth Circuit, which recognize that that is, in fact, a final and appealable order that could have res judicata effect if left to become final. And that's what happened here. So whatever claims the Gagnards could have made against Goldman, relating to the set-off issue, the demurrer order, as we refer to it in our brief, was the second order that gained preclusive effect as to that issue, the first one being the arbitration award, which they did not challenge. But even if you credit the Gagnards' argument that the arbitrator somehow didn't decide the merits of that issue, certainly by the time the Campy demurrer order was entered, the die had been cast, because that was litigation between the Goldmans and the Gagnards, where the Gagnards again said, look, we're entitled to a set-off. The judge said, nope, res judicata. And it was incumbent upon them at that point to appeal to the California Court of Appeal and explain to that tribunal why the arbitrator didn't really decide that issue, and it really should not have been given res judicata effect before the Superior Court of California. Excuse me. And then, but the additional litigation marched on, and this time now we are in the federal court in the Northern District of California, where Mrs. Goldman was attempting to confirm her arbitration award under the Federal Arbitration Act and turn it into an enforceable federal judgment. Now, again, the Goldmans, or the Gagnards rather, their strategic decisions that they made in those prior fora govern what happens here. In the Federal Arbitration Act proceeding, at the time it was filed, a little bit of chronology is necessary here, the Campy decision dismissing their claim with prejudice had not yet been entered. So that's why, as Your Honors acknowledged during Mr. Epstein's time, that their first defensive move before the federal judge in San Francisco was to ask for a stay, giving the Superior Court enough time to rule on Goldman's motion to dismiss. Once that motion to dismiss had been granted, Goldman naturally brought that to the attention of Judge Koh in San Francisco, and Judge Koh responded by ordering the Gagnards to either withdraw the motion to stay as being moot or file a paper explaining to her why that motion had not become moot in light of the Superior Court's order. Again, the Gagnards made a strategic decision. What did they do? They withdrew their motion for stay, which effectively took the setoff issue off the table, withdrew it from consideration in the FAA case. And the precedents we cited in our brief demonstrate that withdrawing an issue like that is a voluntary act that results in a waiver. So then the prejudgment interest issue came up, obviously, for the first time there. And the judge read the authorities that were cited by the Gagnards, but decided that issue against them on the merits pursuant to applicable California law, which allowed prejudgment interest to be granted to a victorious plaintiff sitting as a result of this type of judgment. Now, on this point, there's another myth that sort of made its way through this case, that somehow an Arbitration Act, FAA judgment, even if erroneous, somehow can damage the district court's jurisdiction. Now, that is false also. The district court in California, incontestably and as conceded by the appellants, had diversity jurisdiction. The FAA is not a jurisdictional statute, so the decision to award prejudgment interest has exactly nothing to do with jurisdiction. And the Gagnards, in that context, ignore the authority that we cited in our brief, particularly the Fifth Circuit's recent decision in a case called Hamstein, where they said, you know, look, if a judge in an FAA case enters an order under the Federal Arbitration Act that the losing party has a problem with, it just cannot divest a district court of jurisdiction that it already has. So, in sum, I see my light is on. This case, as I said at the outset, was decided below on matters of procedure, that it is impossible to counterclaim when there has been no pleading filed by an opposing party asserting a claim. I've decided to use the balance of my oral remarks to deal with the preclusion issues, which were not reached by the district judge below, but they obviously provide an alternate basis to affirm, even if this court disagrees with Judge Terra's conclusions for dismissing the counterclaim asserted below. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Counsel says, erroneously, that the Gagnards lost the set-off issue. He says there were adverse rulings on the set-off. That is 100% false. There is a difference between losing an issue and a rejection of consideration of the issue. And that's what you have here. The arbitrator declined to consider and rule on either the allocation or the ensuing set-off issue. The confirming court said it wasn't before her. The Campy court said, didn't address that issue. He addressed the award. Now, nobody...
Wait a minute. In the Campy case, a demur to the counterclaim was sustained. The counterclaim was dismissed.
Correct. It was a cross-claim, but yes.
Cross-claim, whatever you want.
Yeah, but that claim was not a post-judgment set-off against the judgment. That claim that was made was a claim to reduce the arbitration award. That was what was rejected. And that's a correct jurisdictional rejection. You can't...
To reduce the arbitration award because of the settlement with the contract.
Right. That's the wrong... It was a request for...
I don't care what you call it. It's what it is. It's the set-off issue.
But there is a difference. There is a fundamental legal difference between an arbitration award and a judgment later imposed upon that award. That's the reason that the Federal Arbitration Act and the Uniform Arbitration Act call for the entry of a judgment. The judgment has different consequences. The relief that was requested there, frankly, was the wrong relief. It was a relief from the award. The award was correct. The award determined the liability. Now, the separate question is, who has to pay the liability? Other people were also liable for the same injury. That's a different issue, and there was no ruling on that. And moreover, counsel says that was a final order, the dismissal. It would have been a final order had there ever been a final order in the case. They don't address the cases, we cite a bunch of them, where what would have been a final order, the case gets settled. And the courts consistently say, if the case is finally settled, and there's no appeal because there's a settlement, you don't have res judicata. That's their problem. You don't have res judicata anywhere here. Now, the reason for a rejection, not just a rejection or a denial of a motion or a denial of a claim, the reason is critical for res judicata purposes. I plead with the court to look at the reasons that all of these forums rejected the claim.
Well, ancillary proceedings are going to get awfully messy if you're right in this case.
You have
to. Registration of a judgment
becomes
all this trail of troubles.
You have that inherently. You have a judgment. If a third-party payment occurs after the judgment, which not this case. Actually, it is, because there were payments made in the Campy case. But that has to be litigated. You can't say, well, the judgment is here, and you never get an offset, even if the offset arises later. Of course you litigated in enforcement proceedings. That's the right place to litigate it. Otherwise, the rule which this court has endorsed, the Illinois courts, the California courts, the rule against multiple recovery is gone. Why? Because you divided jurisdiction. You divided and you conquered and you got paid three times. That shouldn't happen, and that's what we ask this court not to allow. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you very much to all parties, and the case will be taken under advisement. Thank you. And we're going to go on to appeal number 132505.